Okay, let's try and kind of focus on the passage. You may have observed, we've been in John's Gospel for a lot of this term. And one of the reasons is we've actually been doing something unusual for seven. We've been kind of following the lectionary readings that the Church of England has. And kind of, you know, spending time in John's Gospel makes sense. What hasn't made quite as much sense is the way we have jumped around. So kind of we've been early on in Jesus' life, and then we've been close to his death, then we've been back early on. It doesn't feel like it's gone through it in a logical order. Well, tonight, we are kind of, we're closer to where we ought to be, but it still feels a bit out of sync. This passage takes place in the week before Jesus' death. Hence kind of the predictions of his death and how so much of it's focused on that. But what is kind of weird is it takes place after his triumphal entry into Jerusalem, and Palm Sunday, which is next week, is the week when we think about that. So it's still a bit out of sync. It picks up though on themes we've already been looking at, and you would have, if you've been around, you'd be aware we've been thinking a little bit about who Jesus is. And we've also been thinking about what Jesus came to do. And we kind of introduced this theme, kind of coming from John 3 last week, about this idea of Jesus being lifted up and drawing people to himself and us putting our trust in him. And that theme kind of returns to us again in this passage. But that's kind of later in tonight's story. So it begins with what I think is an unusual encounter. I don't think I'm alone in thinking that. There are some Greeks that come looking for Jesus. Now, it's not unusual that they would be in Jerusalem. If you remember Pentecost, one of the things that marks Pentecost out is that when the Holy Spirit fell on the disciples and they spoke in other languages, there were people in the city for the feast that came from lots of the countries and the cities that those languages represented. So kind of foreigners were in the city for the Feast of Pentecost. And this is in the run-up to the Feast of Passover. So the idea that people would visit for this feast from other countries and other cultures isn't totally unusual. But what is interesting is that they seek out Jesus. And it, for me, that kind of speaks volumes of the fact that Jesus must have had quite an impact in Jerusalem just in the few days that he's been there since his triumphal entry, for them to know about him as visitors and to specifically come and seek him out. So actually that in itself is quite fascinating. These people, these foreigners that come to Jerusalem, are often referred to as God-fearers. And if you think they come from a Greek culture, kind of Greek culture is dominated by many, many different gods that people worship. And they seem to be drawn to Judaism because of monotheism, because of the belief in one God. And so kind of, you know, it's like they've come from a culture where people are searching, and they are searching, and there are so many different kind of deities that reflect that. And these people seem to be finding an answer to that search kind of in the God that's revealed through Judaism. And so they seem to be people that fear God. They are people that are searching after God. And that seems to be what's brought them to Jerusalem in the first place, and now to Jesus. And it strikes me there's a little bit of a similarity in this with the wise men that came to Jesus at Jesus' birth. Again, they were people that were kind of, they were looking for something, and they're captivated by the star, and they're drawn to Israel because of that. And it seems to me that there's the same kind of message behind both. You know, when the wise men kind of come and worship Jesus at Jesus' birth, there's a reminder right at the birth of Jesus that his significance is greater than just the Jewish nation. He hasn't just come here for kind of the Jewish people. He's here for everyone. It kind of anticipates the fact that people from every kind of nation will come to believe in Jesus. And here, as we approach Jesus' death with these Greeks searching Jesus out, there's a kind of another reminder that just as his birth had significance for the whole of the world, so his death has a significance that goes beyond the Jewish people. It has a significance for everyone. And the Greeks' request is memorable. Sir, we would see Jesus. It's probably been the text of an awful lot of sermons over the years. It's a sort of, if you like going around old churches and having a nose around and kind of looking at the plaques and things like that, kind of if you look inside pulpits, you will often find there's a brass plaque there. And generally, it's something that's been put there to G up the preacher, you know, to remind them of the seriousness of what they're about. And on more than one occasion, I've come across this text on a brass plaque in a pulpit. Sir, we would see Jesus. And actually, in a way, isn't that the goal of all preaching? That it should reveal Jesus to us, should point us to Jesus. And so these Greeks come searching and searching for Jesus. And kind of, it may have been spoken 2,000 years ago, but it kind of seems to me that that desire for Jesus kind of still resonates with the human heart today. 2,000 years ago, there was something attractive about Jesus that drew people to him. And it seems to be all encompassing. It was there in his words. You remember kind of how, when the crowds listened to him, they were rapt with what he had to say. And sometimes they said things that kind of showed you kind of how they felt about it. You know, one classic saying in Mark's gospel is, he teaches as one who has authority. Kind of, there's a weight to his words. You have to sit up and take notice. And then there's this little kind of subtext, and you can start to get an understanding why he wasn't very popular with the Pharisees. You know, he teaches as one with authority, not like the scribes and Pharisees. It's like a vicar's worst nightmare, you know. Katie preaches as one with authority, not like the vicar. You can kind of get why people were resentful, but it kind of speaks volumes of how Jesus's words were arresting. He drew crowds that wanted to just sit at his feet and listen. They filled hillsides. They packed themselves into buildings to the point that people had to rip the roof off to lower people into the buildings. Kind of such was the power of his words. It wasn't just his words, but his actions that drew people. It's almost like he turned the world upside down. The sick were healed. The blind had their sight restored. The deaf heard. The lame walked. The dead were raised. Demons were cast out. It kind of feels like wherever Jesus went, people were waiting with bated breath to kind of see what would happen next. No wonder they were drawn to him. And it is fascinating. We talked a bit last week about how in our society we have this tendency to put people on pedestals. And the comment I made was the problem with that is we kind of discover very quickly that they have feet of clay and they have failings. Or kind of also there's a tendency in our society, the moment we put someone on a pedestal, we want to kind of go out of our way to pull them down. And there's nothing that the papers like more than being able to report on how horrible this celebrity was to this person or that person. They had a rant at the airport and they weren't very kind to the baggage handlers. And, you know, and we kind of suddenly realise that this person we put on a pedestal isn't very nice at all. Well, actually, one of the things that comes through with Jesus is that actually there was kind of a consistency that was both in his words and his deeds, but also in his attitude to others. The broken and the humble were always welcome. He touched the people that everyone regarded as unclean. He touched lepers. He spent time with outcasts, with those that kind of society had no time for. And he didn't suck up to the people that were powerful. Often he kind of brought them down a peg or two. So it kind of feels like when, you know, it wasn't just one aspect of who he was. It's like the whole person was consistent. And that's something often kind of it feels like it lacks from our lives, or kind of the people we see. You know, we talk about people being really gifted, but actually not being very nice, you know, kind of. And that's interesting. And it seems to me that 2,000 years later, people are still drawn to Jesus. I don't know about you. I don't know your stories, kind of why you're here tonight, why kind of you kind of are a Christian, or are asking questions of Christianity. And I would say category from a personal point of view, it was never church or religion that kind of drew me to faith. Ultimately, it was Jesus that attracted me, that captivated me, that made me want to know more, that kind of left me ending up doing this kind of job, even, you know? So kind of there's still this sense that there is something about Jesus, you know, that captures people's heart. People may not know what to make of him. If you were to do a survey of who was Jesus, we would probably come out with many of the answers we talked about a couple of weeks ago. You know, oh, he was a good man, or he was a prophet, or something like that. But there's still, even if people don't quite know what to make of him, they're still attracted to him. And ultimately what's going on is what Jesus predicts in this passage. When I am lifted up, I will draw all people to myself. That's kind of what we see happening here. It's what Jesus predicts. And actually, I think it's still true to a great extent. It's almost like the evidence is in our lives. So we have Jesus and we have these Greeks that visit him. And then we have Philip and Andrew. The Greeks first approach Philip, and then Philip goes and finds Andrew, and the two of them approach Jesus. So why do they go to Philip? Well, first of all, Philip's name is actually a Greek name. So they may have heard his name and thought, oh, he's one of us. He probably wasn't a Greek, but if you kind of know your history, you would know that before the Romans ruled over Israel, the Greeks ruled over Israel. And in the time that they ruled over it, they made it quite Greek. The term is they Hellenized it. So kind of there was a lot of Greek culture that was absorbed into Israel. And if you kind of ever wonder, well, why are the Pharisees so hooked up on obeying the rules? Well, one of the reasons is it was a reaction towards kind of their culture becoming more and more secular and Greek. So they wanted to put the emphasis on keeping the rules. But part of that kind of Hellenization was that people would have been given Greek names, not just Jewish names. So probably Philip wasn't necessarily Greek, but he kind of came from someone that came from that kind of Greek background that have been influenced by it. And just his name would probably have made him feel approachable to them in a way that others might. And it's interesting, if you know the New Testament, you will know that both Philip and Andrew have a track record of bringing people to Jesus. It's Andrew who first tells his brother, Simon, who becomes Simon Peter, we found the Messiah. And it's Philip who seeks out another one of the disciples, Nathanael, and tells him, we found the one Moses wrote about in the law and about whom the prophets also wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. And so it kind of seems to me that both are models of the sort of people we ought to be. People that bring others to Jesus. You know, and our role is to point people to Jesus. And it just kind of begs that question. Do people know that we follow Jesus? And often we can kind of be a bit diffident about letting on about that. But when we do, I think we can be surprised by people's responses. I think some of you, probably most of you know, you can never get hold of the vicar on a Wednesday evening because I play tennis. And I play tennis with a bunch of non-Christians down at the sports centre. And I, on the whole, kind of go out of my way not to let on that I'm a vicar when I meet people for the first time. Kind of feels like, you know, they kind of put you in a box the moment, you know, they know you're a vicar. They try not to swear around you and things like that. It's also kind of saves me from a bit of embarrassment because when I do things like playing tennis, I can get a bit mouthy. Now, I know that would surprise you. You would find that really hard to believe. But sometimes when I miss and it goes wrong, kind of, it may not be expletive ridden, but you can kind of get the drift that I'm not happy with myself. One of my worst habits is when I win a point, kind of sometimes I celebrate my success and the person I'm playing against's kind of failure a little bit more vociferously than perhaps is kind of it's not necessarily gracious. But it does amaze me that kind of how quickly people have caught on to the fact that I'm a vicar. And kind of when new people join the group, how the people, I don't want to tell them I'm a vicar, but everyone else in the group somehow wants to parade me as their private vicar, even though they don't go to church, which is seriously a bit weird. And then there's this, but you can't be a vicar kind of business, because vicars don't shout like that and jump up and down. And what's got even weirder is Carol started doing Pilates on a Tuesday evening. This isn't because we want to avoid each other. I go out Wednesdays, she goes out Tuesdays. We don't have to see each other at all. It's just kind of that was just convenient. And what we hadn't realised was there's a crossover. Some of the people that I play tennis with know the people that she plays Pilates with. Makes you realise what a small world Tunbridge Wells is. Most of them seem to have kids at St John's School, and that seems to be the common point in it all, actually. Yes, yeah, never mind. Kind of, so quite quickly they've cottoned on that she's a vicar's wife. And then some of them came along to the Christmas event. They all went out for a drink the other evening, and they were talking about it. And some of them said, what, you mean, I didn't realize Christmas, I missed the Christmas event. And he said, why didn't someone tell me it was on? Then it came out that we had the film night. Anyone come to the film night? Dawn came to the film night. And they were saying, oh, you had the film, why didn't you tell us? We would all come to your film night. Now these are all people that kind of don't do church, but it's fascinating that they are wanting to kind of point to people that do church, and they're actually really quite positive about saying, oh, St. Matt's does really great stuff. You really ought to go along to stuff that they do. And I find it quite fascinating because our reaction is often the opposite of that. We expect people to kind of not be interested, but actually it's surprising when we let people know how fascinated they can be and the questions they can have. And I know I've got a funny opportunity, you know, my opportunity and their response to me is probably different because I am a vicar, but it just shows under the surface, people have got questions and they're looking for answers and they're more open, I think, than we might expect. I think one of the reasons why we kind of hold back is perhaps we think people aren't interested or we can feel like we're actually not a great example of a follower of Jesus, or we're not very good at explaining stuff. And actually, I don't know that we have to worry about that. If you think about Philip, actually, it didn't start out very well for him. When he goes to Nathanael and says, I think we found the Messiah, it's Jesus of Nazareth, what does Nathanael do? Jump up and down and say, great, I want to meet him. He turns around and says, you must be joking. Can anything good come out of Nazareth? You know, so kind of he's not at all impressed by Philip. But in the end, he's impressed by Jesus. And I think that's it. It's our job to point people to Jesus. Actually, it's Jesus that ultimately draws people to himself. We aren't responsible for that. Now, I don't know about you, I like to know the end of stories. And then I'm a little bit frustrated because we don't kind of get to hear what happens next. We're not told whether the Greeks have their interview with Jesus. We're not told whether or not they kind of want to become followers of Jesus. It's funny, they may have stayed in Jerusalem and been amongst a crowd that heard Peter preach on Pentecost and start to follow Jesus. But unfortunately, it doesn't give us any of those answers. They're drawn to Jesus. They anticipate what's going to follow, people from every nation becoming followers of Jesus. But we don't get to find out what happens to them. But what does follow is Jesus talks about drawing people to himself. And his words echo a little bit that passage we looked at last week when we talked about the bronze snake being raised up in the wilderness and how Jesus was saying, just as that snake was raised up, so I need to be raised up. So when people put their trust in me, they're going to have life. And he kind of echoes that when he talks about being lifted up here. He said, the Son of Man must be lifted up. And John kind of explains it. It's not the kind of, you know, we said this last week, it's not the kind of being lifted up we kind of think of a celebrity, but it's about being lifted up on the cross. And John says he said this to show the kind of death that he was going to die. And it's striking that, you know, this is following on from his entry into Jerusalem. This moment of great public adoration when he's declared to be the Messiah by the people. And yet Jesus is still under no illusion. He knows why he's come. And he knows that the ultimate end of that is the cross. Jesus isn't going to be glorified by a crowd that shouts his name. He's going to be glorified by a crowd that shouts, crucify. The place of pain and suffering in the economy of God is the place of the greatest glory. Interesting the phrase that of the song that Ali was playing a moment ago. I noted it down because it just sort of struck me. The life I live finds meaning in surrender. And kind of the world says that we find meaning in being noticed by other people, in being put on a platform. And that's completely the opposite of Christianity. Christianity is completely countercultural. Kind of Jesus goes on to talk about a grain of wheat having to fall to the ground and die. Otherwise, it just remains a seed. But if it dies, if it goes into the ground, then it produces many seeds. That's the economy of the kingdom of God. And Jesus' death is more than a demonstration of God's love. It is a demonstration of God's love. There is no greater demonstration of the love of God that his son was willing to die for us. It's also a life-giving event. Jesus willingly dies that we might live. No wonder people are still drawn to Jesus. Let's pray.